Welcome to the History Podcast, guys. This is your host, Jason Thomason. Let's get started. Welcome to the podcast. We are picking up with part two of our episode on Teddy Roosevelt. And as I mentioned in the first podcast, the hardest part about a podcast on Teddy Roosevelt is trying to figure out a way to condense all that is Teddy Roosevelt into something that everybody can take home in a short amount of time and still do him justice, because he is one of the most unique figures that has ever sat in the Oval Office. And we left off with the first part of our series where he has just taken office. He replaces William McKinley after McKinley is assassinated in 1901. And Teddy is going to take on kind of this persona of the champion for the Progressive Party. You know, while he is a Republican, he even writes letters that says he doesn't see himself as a Republican. And kind of the negative notion there with the Republican Party at this time is that they are in the pocket of big business. And Teddy is not one of those guys. Teddy is going to champion the cause of the progressives in the sense that he's going to try to clean up industry. He's going to try to increase wages. He's going to try to make the workplace safer. And he's going to try in certain ways to reduce the workday for the everyday American. All items that both the labor unions and the progressives were trying to do. He's also going to go after trusts. And there, Teddy would like for you to believe during his time in office that he's going after all trusts. But again, going back to what we talked about in the previous episode, there's a difference between the way Teddy Roosevelt saw trusts and the way that his handpicked predecessor, will see trusts. And that is that Teddy saw certain trusts as okay and good for the government, and he turned a blind eye to them, but saw others as a problem for the economy and would go after them, whereas Taft went after all trusts. And one of the names that Teddy is going to love the most that is given to him, he just loves the nickname the Trust Buster. And you'll see political cartoons that come out where Teddy is really going after big business and breaking up the trusts. Teddy ate that up because Teddy loved himself some Teddy. But in reality, William Taft, a guy that he will eventually be at odds with, who is a really close friend to him at the time, went after trust far more than Teddy did. But Teddy just had a bigger personality, and Teddy was a master at creating his own narrative. He will use a bill that's already on the books, a bill that has not been properly enforced, and that is the Sherman Antitrust Act. And he's going to use that to file suits against monopolies throughout the country. And one of his biggest enemies during his administration is financier J.P. Morgan, who has a lot of trusts and a lot of interests throughout the country that he feels are going to be jeopardized by the enforcement of the Antitrust Act. Teddy will also campaign for the passage of the Hepburn Act. Now, most people don't know about the Hepburn Act, but what you need to understand about the Hepburn Act is that it's going to regulate freight rates. But what I want to kind of hit on and focus on with the Hepburn Act is not necessarily the actual piece of legislation, but how he got it passed. What we're going to see Teddy Roosevelt do in order to get momentum built by the constituents to put pressure on their congressmen to pass this bill is he's going to travel across the country. And he's going to campaign for this bill. We've never seen a president to this point campaign for the passage of a bill. I mean, he's the president of the United States. He's in the executive branch. He doesn't write the law. He doesn't vote on the law. He just executes the law. He either signs it into law or vetoes it. But his job is to execute the law. And This shows you kind of how Teddy Roosevelt interprets what the Constitution says about the executive branch. When you think about George Washington, our country's first president, one of the things that he constantly did was he would ask, "What does the Constitution say that I can do? If it doesn't explicitly say that I can do it, I'm not going to do it." Conversely, Teddy's going to say, "If the Constitution doesn't say that I can't do it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to push the boundaries because if it doesn't say that I can't do it, I'm going to do it." And you can kind of see how he is transforming the office of the presidency and how, when we look at politics in 2019, none of this stuff is unique. You know, it came from somewhere, and much of what we see in modern politics originates from this administration, the 26th president, Teddy Roosevelt. He's going to campaign around the country for the Hepburn Act, which would allow the government to more strictly regulate freight rates, and he'll get it passed, and then he will sign it into law. Teddy was not a yes man, and the Republicans who thought that they were going to send him off on a farewell tour as vice president to McKinley are now having to deal with a guy in the office who will not listen to them. And that is so frustrating to the political bosses, and I think that's just absolutely hilarious. I've always loved that dynamic between Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Rider, and Republican Party bosses who have always gotten their way, and they don't get their way with the one and only TR. Another way that Teddy Roosevelt is going to take on kind of the cause of the progressive movement, it's all a part of what we know historically as the Square Deal. Teddy used to kind of reference the Square Deal, and the Square Deal is going to focus on those progressive ideals that he's going to champion. And one side of that Square Deal is to clean up the social issues that the progressives have been complaining about for years. There'll be a book written during the Progressive Era by a man by the name of Upton Sinclair. Upton Sinclair is going to expose the atrocities going on in the meatpacking industry, things that you would be absolutely appalled by. Men working in factories where the conditions are unsafe. Meat that is spoiled is mixed with meat that's okay because nobody will know the difference once it's put into the meat grinder. Factories where the conditions are so poor that it's rat infested and rats mingle around, they're looking and they fall into the meat grinder. They're not going to stop the meat grinder because a rat fell in. They'll just mix it up because nobody will know the difference. Men go to the bathroom and do their business and then come back out. They don't wash their hands and then they go right back to handling the meat. Nobody's going to know the difference. And this book, The Jungle, which was written by Upton Sinclair, is going to expose the problems of the meatpacking industry. You'll also see progressives like Jacob Riis, who will take photographs of the slums of major cities, exposing people to things that either they did not want to know about or they actually had no clue what was going on in the inner cities. These poverty-stricken places were so run down that feces just sat in the street where kids would play and run around. Kids were starving. Political bosses were taking advantage of these areas, promising jobs and money in exchange for votes. And Riis will take pictures of these, and the movement is building within the Progressive Party, or the, excuse me, the Progressive Movement to invoke change. The problem in the past has been they've never really had anybody in Washington willing and able to do anything about it, and that is until Teddy Roosevelt is in office, and Teddy takes it upon himself to help the progressives. And while you'll see the two guys that follow him actually probably get more done, Roosevelt would probably argue that they wouldn't have been able to do what they did if it weren't for me getting the ball rolling. And I think to a certain extent, he's probably correct. But some of the things that he will do, number one, he's going to get the Pure Food and Drug Act passed. And the Pure Food and Drug Act is going to create a federal agency that is still around in 2019 known as the Food and Drug Administration. And it's because of the Pure Food and Drug Act that we can eat a hamburger and not have to worry about it being something that's going to kill us. He's also going to take it upon himself to protect national parks, to protect endangered species and wildlife, birds, because he loved the outdoors. Now, that is a little bit of a contradiction because he was such an avid big game hunter. But Teddy felt like if we just kept pouring concrete, for lack of a better term, everywhere across the country, that we wouldn't have these magical places to go, these majestic places that are protected by the government, where you can go and you can see God's creation. Teddy's also a big talker. Teddy can enter a room and he immediately takes over the conversation. Part of that is just the amount of information he has running through his head. He's so smart. He is so incredibly intelligent. But he can be exhausting with how much he talks. And if you've ever known anybody like that, it's hard to get a word in. And one of my favorite stories about Teddy Roosevelt in the White House, it's so hilarious and it's so Teddy Roosevelt, but he had heard that there was this big game hunter, and he was, you know, a hunter himself, as we've mentioned before, but he was fascinated with this guy. It was this famous big game hunter from England, and he had heard that he was in Washington, and so he told his staff, he said, "Hey, I want you to find that guy and bring him here. I want to meet him." So they do as told, and they find this big game hunter. He's this big, burly, you know, strong hunter. You know, he just looks the part, and he walks into the Oval. They close the door behind him, and he's in there for a long time. And the staff is kind of listening, and they can hear conversation going on. And after some time, the door opens, and the avid hunter from England walks out, and he looks just beat down, just completely beat down. And the staff said, "What did you say to the president?" And he looked at him and he said, "I told him my name." And that was just, you know, that is just Teddy Roosevelt in a nutshell. I mean, you're lucky if you can get your name in before he starts talking your head off. I mean, he wants you to hear what he has to say, because what he has to say in his mind is the most important thing. When it comes to foreign policy, though, I think that, you know, it may be the largest change that we see in terms of the direction that his presidency took. Yes, he is going to promote a lot of progressive ideals domestically, and that is something that our country has not seen to this point. But from a foreign policy standpoint, we're going to see TR change course for the United States. After 1898 and the success in the Spanish-American War, we have now entered the world stage as a world power. The key word is A. We are a world power. And while Teddy is not alone, Teddy has the biggest voice, and he is listening to people like Alfred Thayer Mahan, Henry Cabot Lodge, both men who believe that America needs to expand its sphere of influence, not only throughout Central America, but into South America and into all parts of the Western Hemisphere. And Roosevelt kind of takes that and runs with it. And he is flirting with going over the line. because he is approaching areas that, constitutionally speaking, we're not sure that the president has the authority to do some of the things that he will do. But he is going to add to a foreign doctrine that we've already had in place, and that was the Monroe Doctrine. And back when James Monroe was president, he warned the Europeans to stay out of American affairs. And Roosevelt is going to add to that. And Roosevelt's corollary, as we call it, is going to not only warn Europeans to stay out of American affairs, but that it is our job as the United States to police the entire Western Hemisphere. And this is a moment in time where we begin to shift our focus from North America and worrying about making sure that our interests within North America and Central America are taken care of, to where now we are entering a realm that we are unfamiliar with. And Roosevelt does so fearlessly. He also believes that our Navy needs to not only increase in terms of numbers, but we need to put and pour more resources into our Navy. He believes our Navy is kind of a joke. And he wants, as our we talked about in part one, he was the U.S. Navy Secretary. And even then, he was talking about we needed to pour money into the Navy. Chester A. Arthur, who was president from 81 to the end of the term that he finished for Garfield in 84, was really the first president to appropriate more funds into the Navy than ever before. But Roosevelt's going to take it to a new level. And in fact, he's calling on new warships to be built. And he's, the nickname given to this is the Great White Fleet. And once the Great White Fleet is completed, Teddy wants to take this Great White Fleet on what he calls a goodwill tour across the globe. Well, as you can imagine, how expensive that goodwill tour would be to move somewhere in the ballpark of 15 brand new naval ships across the globe on a goodwill tour, Congress was not real thrilled about the idea of paying for that. And so when it was presented to Congress that Teddy wanted to take the Great White Fleet on a goodwill tour, Congress said, "Mr. President, we're not going to approve that because it's too expensive. I mean, the amount of fuel that we'll have to use is far too expensive for Congress to approve." And Teddy says, "No, I don't think you understand. We're going to do it." And Congress and repeatedly said, both parties, "Mr. President, we are not going to approve this tour." And finally, Teddy gets so fed up. He gets so completely fed up with Congress that he says, "All right, here's the deal. I'm going to pay for it out of my own pocket." And as the story goes, he says, "And when I run out of money, and I will, you guys can explain to the American people why our naval ships are stuck out at sea." And he walks out of the room. And I can just imagine the way the Democratic congressman looked at the Republican congressman, like, is this guy for real? And the Republican congressman, who have to deal with him on a constant basis, said, "He's, you know, he's serious." I can just see that conversation going on. And they, lo and behold, approve the goodwill tour. That's just how convincing Teddy could be. He's also going to support behind closed doors, and this is something that a lot of people who oppose the administration of Teddy Roosevelt will challenge, and they will say that this was borderline impeachable, but he will support the Panamanian Rebellion to overthrow the Colombians, who were controlling Panama at the time, in exchange for the land to build the Panama Canal, something that Teddy felt was necessary for the United States moving forward. He wanted to be able to move Navy ships from the East Coast to West Coast or vice versa in time of emergency. And he felt like it was way too inefficient, which it was. I mean, you would have to go all the way south of South America just to get from one coast to the other. And he wanted to oversee the project. Now, while it wasn't complete during his, or completed rather, during his administration, he did go over to Panama to see how the progress was going, which, by the way, also makes him the first. He's a president of many firsts. He's the first president while sitting in office to leave the country. And that's a big deal. And, you know, eventually the Panama Canal will be completed. It will be completed after he is out of office. We will control the Panama Canal. This is a little bit of a side note for you. We will control the Panama Canal until the administration of Jimmy Carter relinquishes that control back to the Panamanians in the 1970s. A couple of accomplishments of Roosevelt in terms of being a mediator, and this kind of goes back to Teddy being a guy that knows how to bring sides together and convince people of things that they initially probably went into the conversation dead set on, and by the time they leave, Teddy's convinced them otherwise. I want to talk about two specifically. Number one was the coal strike. The coal strike takes place. Obviously, coal miners have a very difficult job. It's very dangerous work. They go on strike because they're working extremely long hours. Their pay is terrible. And naturally, they're working in very unsafe conditions. And their coal bosses are not listening to their demands whatsoever. So they go on strike. Well, the problem is we're entering the winter. And Teddy is afraid that if this strike isn't resolved, that people will freeze, that, you know, especially in the upper Northeast, they will freeze to death. And so he brings both sides in and essentially won't let them leave until a deal is done. He tells the coal bosses that if you decide to walk away from the table right now, I'm going to use my authority, which he wasn't really sure he had the authority to do, but I'm going to take over the coal mines. I'm going to federalize, is what he called, federalize the coal mines to keep the coal mines open so that we have heat for the winter. Now, they could have called his bluff, but they didn't. And that's how convincing Teddy was. They come to the table and they, to a certain extent, raise pay. They drop the daily work hours down, but not very much. But it resolves the problem in the temporary, keeps heat in the homes, and keeps the American people safe. But arguably the biggest negotiation that Teddy was a part of during his administration was with the Russo-Japanese War. They had been at war, Russia and Japan had been at war for 2 years, and Teddy wanted to bring that to an end. He didn't want this to play out. He didn't want the Russians to win because he felt like that would give them too much influence in Europe. He didn't want the Japanese to win because he was afraid of what kind of message that would send to their, to our allies in the Pacific. And so he brings them in, and things are not going well at all. And it is said that Teddy kind of barricaded himself in the doorway when things continued to worsen in the negotiations and said, we're not leaving until we get a deal done. He will get a deal done with the Russo-Japanese War, bringing it to an end. And a side note on this, Teddy, another first here, Teddy becomes the first president in American history to win a Nobel Peace Prize. And there have been a few since then that have won Nobel Peace Prizes. Wilson, FDR, I believe, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter got his for the Camp David Peace Accords. And then President Barack Obama. So there have been presidents since then that have won, but he was the first to do so. And it was because he was truly masterful when it came to bringing in people from different backgrounds who may not like him at all, and convince them that this is what's best for everybody. And if he still couldn't get it across to you, he'd bully you. I mean, he was also the master at using the bully pulpit, excuse me. And there's only one Teddy Roosevelt, and the Russo-Japanese War proves just that. Teddy was so popular as a president because he resonated with the everyday American. And in 1908, he is not going to run again. He will be what he considers a two-termer, although he technically wasn't. He finished McKinley's term, and then he won his own term in a landslide in 1904. But during that 1904 campaign season, he told the American people that he would consider that his second term and would not run again. Now, if you're confused at all, there is no law at this point in time that says the president can't run more than two terms. That precedence was set by George Washington, who unanimously won twice, and the American people tried and tried and tried to get him to run for a third term, and would have been elected easily for the third term, but decided that it was time for him to step away because he was afraid of power. He was terrified of what power could do. And so he willingly relinquished that power and stepped away. And every president since that time has followed suit, because if it was good enough for Washington, it's good enough for me. And so when we get to Roosevelt, Roosevelt says the same thing. Now, he didn't win that first term, but he considered that because it was pretty much a full term, because he took over so early in McKinley's second term. But he said, "I'm going to consider that my own term, and if I win in 1904, I will not seek re-election in 1908." People around him were saying, "You are an idiot. Why are you doing this? You're so popular. You're so popular. You would win easily again in 1908. Don't count yourself out this early." It would be, in the end, a decision that he would regret. Now, in 1908, he will handpick the guy who will replace him on the Republican ticket, and that is his dear friend, William Howard Taft. Taft had served in the Roosevelt administration. He had also served as the governor of the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. Taft is a policy wonk. He's a guy that just digests the law, like most of us digest, chips and salsa. I mean, he just loves the law. And because of Teddy's popularity, Taft will win in a landslide because of his endorsement. Roosevelt is hopeful that Taft will continue many of the progressive policies that he got rolling. But the hard thing for Teddy Roosevelt is that Teddy's not going to be in the spotlight anymore. And that's going to be a real challenge for him. Now, initially, he's going to force himself to get away. He's going to go on a trip to Africa, where he'll do some big game hunting. And there's so many photos out there where you can see game that he's killed: elephants, lions. There's all giraffes. There's all sorts of stuff that he killed along the way on his African safari. In fact, funny story. This shows you how much J.P. Morgan hated Teddy Roosevelt. When Morgan received word that Roosevelt was going on an African safari, Morgan said something to the effect of, "I think I speak for the American people when I say, I hope the lions do their job," meaning, "I hope the lions kill him." And that just shows you how many enemies he made with the business world, because of his enforcement of the antitrust laws. But so he spends some time with his son Kermit in Africa, returns home, and it's killing him. It's killing him that he is not in the spotlight. And for personalities like Roosevelt, if you don't do things exactly the way he would have done them, he starts getting antsy. He wants to step in and fix things. And this is a recipe for disaster for Roosevelt, who chose himself to step away. Nobody forced him to do this. He chose to do this. Roosevelt starts to kind of find ways to nitpick the way that Taft is doing his job. He starts to criticize Taft for not being progressive enough, although there are a lot of false accusations towards Taft from Roosevelt. Roosevelt was very petty when it came to this. Roosevelt did not file as many lawsuits against big business as Taft did. Taft actually was more of a trust buster, if we're going to get down to it, than Teddy was. But it didn't matter. Teddy was so popular. He was so vocal. He was in your face. He was a larger-than-life figure. And Taft was the exact opposite. He was the antithesis of Roosevelt. Many historians believe that Taft really didn't desire the job of president. They felt like maybe his wife wanted to be first lady more than he wanted to be the president. But once he was in it, I mean, you know, everybody's got that competitive drive in you. And when you're being criticized by someone you consider your best friend, you know, you start to dig your heels in. But it crushed Taft. Taft was, you know, he's going to be the butt of a lot of jokes, not only during his time, he was an overweight guy, but also historically. I mean, everybody kind of remembers Taft for only one thing, and that was getting stuck in the White House bathtub. They had to pry him out physically, pry him out of the bathtub. They had to change the bathtub in the White House to where it could seat. It was like a four-seater because of Taft. And so, you know, he was the butt of a lot of jokes, and he could deal with some of that. But when his own friend, a guy that he considered his best friend in the business, started taking shots at his work ethic, at his credibility, at his character, that crushed Taft privately. Now, publicly, he put on, you know, the brave face, but privately, when you read his memoirs, he talks about how crushed he was because he was basically family. And so when we get to the 1912 campaign season, Teddy's going to want to get back in the game, and he's going to approach the Republican Party about it, the same Republican Party that had a hard time controlling Teddy. So you can kind of see where this is going. He's going to go to them and say, look, Taft, that's on me. That's my bad. I shouldn't have endorsed him. I shouldn't have stepped away. That's on me. And the Republican Party is sitting there saying, you know what? We actually don't have that much of a problem with Taft. But Roosevelt says, I want back in the game. And he wants it put forth at the convention. They go to a vote. And Taft, surprisingly to many, wins. Roosevelt feels like he's been railroaded by the party bosses. So he says, you know what? I don't need the Republican Party. I'll go run on a third party ticket. And he will run on what will eventually become known as the Bull Moose Party ticket. The story of Taft and Teddy is pretty sad because this thing gets really, really nasty in the campaign season of 1912. The ads that will be put out, the jabs that will be given, mostly from Roosevelt to Taft, break this relationship, this friendship that has existed since adulthood. And Taft is crushed, but at the same time, it gets to the point where Taft's just tired of getting bullied. And he said, you know what? Despite Roosevelt making calls for me to drop out of the election, I'm not getting out. Roosevelt desperately wanted Taft to remove himself from the election because he knew what we're eventually going to find out is if both he and Taft stay in, they're going to split each other's vote, and it's going to make the Democratic nominee the next president of the United States. The Democrats are going to nominate a man by the name of Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson is not the most experienced politician out there. In fact, he's the most inexperienced of the three running. He is a professor, or once was a professor, rather. He was also once the president of Princeton University. He has very little political experience. So it's not like he's a shoo-in in this situation. But Teddy's fears were correct. And Taft, I think, personally, this is just my interpretation, I believe Will Taft knew that by staying in, he wasn't going to win. And I think he knew he wasn't going to win. But by staying in, he would keep Roosevelt, who had kind of bullied him throughout this campaign season, would not win as well. And so he just said, you know what? Screw it. I'm staying in. I'm not leaving. If I'm going down, you're going down with me. And that's exactly what happened. They split each other's votes. And Woodrow Wilson wins the election of 1912. And that's pretty much the end of Roosevelt in the spotlight. You know, it's kind of a sad way to go out, but it's not surprising. You know, it's almost fitting that this is the way that Roosevelt goes out on the political stage, where he just could not go away. He just couldn't stay out of the spotlight. He needed and craved the spotlight. An interesting story about the campaign of 1912. I just remembered a story that I wanted to tell. And this shows you how tough Teddy was. On the campaign trail of 1912, Roosevelt is traveling throughout the country. He's getting ready to deliver a speech at his next campaign stop. He's riding in a convertible top. The car stops. He stands up, getting ready to deliver the speech, and he is shot. Gunshots go off. He is shot. He's shot right in the chest. And the bullet goes through his jacket. It goes through his pocket square in his dress shirt, through his glass frame, okay, and it goes through the speech that he had folded and put in that pocket. The bullet fractures a rib, okay? Teddy obviously is taken aback by this. His shirt is covered in blood. He coughs in his hand to see if his lungs were damaged. No blood. Teddy stands up and delivers the speech at the campaign stop. He talked for the next hour and a half with a bullet inside his body. His shirt was drenched in blood. And he showed the people at the stop the shirt that was drenched in blood. I mean, how tough is that? I mean, it's crazy too, but you know, that is incredible. His campaign team was like, you know, you don't need to give this speech. And he just basically brushed them off, told them to get away. After the speech is over, they rush him to the hospital and he's taken care of. The shooter claimed that he had a dream. And in this dream, McKinley told him that Roosevelt had murdered him. And so that's why he shot the president. Weird events in 1912, but nonetheless, Taft only serves one term. And I think when you look back at the progressive reform that Taft's administration pushed through, I think that you'll look back on him and say that he actually did more than Teddy criticized him for not doing. And in fact, I think he was more of a trust buster than TR himself. An interesting note about William Howard Taft. Taft always had a dream of becoming a Supreme Court justice, and he will actually be the first and only president to be appointed to the Supreme Court, and he will be the Supreme Court justice appointed by Warren G. Harding in the 1920s. And there are actually some really cool photos in the 1920s where he will swear in. I believe he swore in Herbert Hoover in 1928, but It's some really cool stuff that Taft is the first and only president to, after his time in office, will serve as a Supreme Court justice. That just shows you how much he loved the law and how much of a policy wonk he was. In terms of Roosevelt's legacy is that he is going to change the office of the presidency in more ways than one, from a domestic standpoint and also from a foreign policy standpoint. He was such a popular president that when his fifth cousin, FDR, is in office, Mount Rushmore is being constructed and sculpted. And they have already placed Washington and Jefferson onto the mountain, and they're getting close to finishing Lincoln. And there is one spot left remaining, and guess who FDR chooses to place on that mountain with the other three legends of the office? That's right, Teddy Roosevelt. That's all we have time for today. I hope that you have enjoyed this condensed version of Roosevelt's administration, both parts of our episode. There are so many stories that I would love to tell on Teddy Roosevelt that we just didn't have time for. If you see me and you want to talk about Teddy Roosevelt, I'd love to talk Teddy Roosevelt with you. Join us next time as we talk about the presidency of Woodrow Wilson and World War I. See you next time. We'd like to encourage you to subscribe to the podcast. You can find us on Apple iTunes. You can find us on Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Please leave us feedback, positive or negative. And always remember, guys, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it.